Welcome to the Ask Zach Show. I'm your host, Zach Childs. I've spent the last 30 years working in the music industry here in Nashville, Tennessee, during which I've done everything from touring with major artists like Brad Paisley and Carrie Underwood to playing the nastiest dive bars or even the occasional wedding. This show is all about barreling down the rabbit hole on all things guitar and the music we love. We will cover the legendary players, gear insights, and even some interviews along the way. I hope you enjoy. To support the show, follow the links in the description to find out about my Patreon page. Or go to my store at AskZach.com to pick up a coffee mug or t-shirt. Now, let's dive in.
Today's episode is a partnership with TrueTone, TrueTone.com. Well, hello, friends, and welcome to the True Tone Lounge. Today we have an extra special episode with two legends of the Nashville musical scene. We have Steve Warner, esteemed singer, songwriter, and guitarist and friend, and Joe Glazer, inventor, guitar repairman, and guitar builder extraordinaire. And we are going to tell a bit of their story and how their stories intersect with these two wonderful Glazer made instruments that he made for Steve and became really kind of part of your look and persona and became something that are just very much identified with you.
Yeah, I think that's correct. And I don't know that a week goes by that I don't have someone asking about Joe and about B-Benders and, you know what I mean, or every few days someone on social or somebody will ask about B-Benders or the Red Telly or the, you know. We're definitely connected. Unfortunately for Joe, we're connected forever, you know. So.
Well, you know, you can imagine the opportunity that it represented. I mean, everybody's career is anchored in some luck, as we know.
Boy, that's for real.
And you have a lot of different opportunities to take advantage of it. But there's a certain amount of, you put time into something and it happens to work out. But for me, that was a huge opportunity.
And you're being modest because you made a lot of your own luck by making awesome instruments. And that's true, not patting backs, but here. But, yeah, those were great guitars. I knew it. Ricky Skaggs knew it. A lot of people, Jimmy Olander, a lot of people knew it early on that you were making some extraordinary instruments. And they were really unique and very cool, you know. So
let's pull back and let's get some context. So, Joe, you were out in California, and your parents were doctors. What kind of doctors were they?
My mom was a psychiatrist.
Yes.
Which probably explains a lot.
Yes, it explains his bedside manner.
I'm sitting there going,
She changed career sort of at a certain point. She was a pediatrician of sorts, and she decided she wanted to go back and become a psychiatrist. And my brother and sister have always insisted it was because as I turned to the dark side, they figured it was a good investment to get ready to help me in my struggles as the black sheep. But that's sort of a joke about bedside manner and all that, but we end up being reflecting our influences.
No question.
And as I got older, I realized that a lot of what I get to bring to the gig, it comes from my mom and my dad.
Yeah. And so you mentioned being a black sheep, and that has to do, of course, with being loving music and getting. And you were a pedal steel player.
In a loose definition, I worked as a pedal steel player.
You were paid. You played gigs.
I was paid. Yeah.
Olander has told me about gigs that you played.
Then you were professional. Yes. You were paid.
So, and you've told me through, you know, some of our own conversations that you loved the kind of the scene that was going on in California for everything from like Buck Owens and Merle Haggard up through like Emmylou and Graham and Rodney Crowell and Albert Lee and all mm-hmm. those characters. And so how did you end up moving to Nashville?
And James Burton, and James Burton, and James Burton.
And James Burton.
Yeah, sure.
Good.
You know, I was playing in a band called Midnight Flyer. It was named after that
Eagles.
Well, it was a tune that the Osborne Brothers did that was written by
I paid my dues and I feel like moving on, traveling on. Midnight Flyer.
Yeah. That, and the guy who wrote
Paul Kraft.
Yeah, Paul Kraft.
Paul Kraft wrote that. Yeah.
Anyway, but we
great did, songwriter.
Great
man.
Songwriter and a self-described genius. He was like, he was in that. What's the society of
Mensa?
Mensa, yeah, and he never let you forget it.
Yeah, just in case you slipped your mind, he would remind you.
Yeah,
he wrote to keep me from blowing away, and he wrote "It's Me Again, Margaret."
And he wrote, "Linda Love Is Sit on My Face," or whatever that thing was. He wrote. He was a great songwriter across a broad spectrum.
And Chet, by the way, a little tidbit, I'm sorry to interrupt, mm-hmm. but he was the last artist that Chet produced on RCA. I was the next to last, and then he signed Paul Kraft, and I went on to work with Tom Collins producing, and then Chet signed Paul Kraft. Mm-hmm. But I thought, a little trivia, he was the last artist that he produced.
He was an interesting cat. I did get to know him, worked on his stuff. Anyway, we were in this band, and there were two really great guitar players in it, and I, playing steel, I was almost useless, except that I was the only person who understood arrangement. And so they called me the Lone Arranger because I kind of was like, whatever anybody else's ideas were, it's like, guys, that's not how it's done. Not everybody plays at once. You don't start in full blast, you build, you know. And so that was kind of that was my role playing the way I played. But these two guitar players were both really good, and there was nobody who worked on instruments. So one of them worked on the other guy's guitar, John Abraham and Rick Eshelman. And it was this, John Abraham would work on the stuff, and he was ham-fisted kind of, you know. And I remember the first time I said, hey, I see what you're doing. Let me just do this for you. And that's where it all came from.
So how did you get to Nashville?
We talked about, so I was doing a Silicon Valley gig, you know, and I've told the story a bunch of times, but I went and interviewed at Hewlett-Packard for this gig. It was with the guy that invented he basically invented the laser printer, and it looked like such a ridiculous, you know, the thing was the size of a room and slow and noisy, and I thought, this is going nowhere. And this girl that I was hanging out with who was thinking about moving to Nashville, April Barros, a jazz songwriter artist, she played bass in the band. She was thinking about moving to Nashville, and I think we misunderstood what was going on in Nashville. Pre-internet, there was no way to see where music was coming from. You'd buy these records. We were joking about Reggie Young earlier today, but it was a long time of knowing that there was a certain sound on a record that it was a long time between figuring out that there was somebody and finding out that the person was named Reggie Young, because there was a Danny O'Keefe record that came out, Good Time Charlie.
Yeah,
the
Blues. Man.
The first record that identified the players where it was Reggie Young. And I didn't know he was from Memphis. I didn't know that all these other people were from L.A. There was no way of knowing. I'd moved here out of the blue, thinking that Haggard and all, that if it was country music, it was coming from Nashville, and that was just totally wrong. So that's how I ended up here.
Yeah. And then you were playing, and how did the guitar building, and then of course that kind of, you know, rolled into repair work, but how did the guitar building start?
It started in California. Two things. One is, I loved a certain kind of music that involved the steel and involved the string bender, with Gene Parsons really, I mean, people have been doing mechanical string bending for a long time, since the 20s, but he and Clarence White turned it into a strap-activated thing for guitar. And I love the sound of it. There's a certain, people can bend strings, but there's a certain style that comes from that mechanical start and stop. And Clarence had his own take on that. And then Bobby Warford had this wonderful slant on Clarence, or they co-developed it, or it's hard to tell. You know, I wasn't around then, so I wasn't there. But those two guys,
man, for real, Warford.
Yeah,
both though. I mean, both are just incredible.
Yeah, and you know, Bob Warford is still. I mean, I've met him online and through you, and communicated with him in the last couple of years, which is a huge reward because he was so influential. He's under-recognized. You know, he's under-appreciated.
Absolutely.
But I was totally fascinated by that sound. And the guy that I was playing with, Rick Eshelman, brought in these songs that he was like, all these songs that featured fairly obscure Willen and that Roadmaster stuff of what's that artist?
Freddie Weller.
Yeah, Freddie Weller. Yeah. The Freddie Weller stuff, the Randy Newman stuff. And we played a number of those songs, and they all had Bender on it. And Rick Eshelman was very good at doing that with his fingers. He could even sort of start and stop as mechanically as anybody
imitate
I've ever heard.
Yeah.
But I just thought, wow, there's a way to do this. And I started messing around with it. Somebody had told me that the Clarence White thing worked, that the neck rotated on the body. And so I took out the four neck bolts and put a center one in and tried that. It was like, yeah, that'll bend the B string, but everything else goes completely to hell.
Right.
And so I thought, can't be that. I tried to go visit Gene Parsons. I drove up to Casper, California, where his place was, and he was out on the road. So I'd seen Clarence, but always from a distance. I didn't have any appreciation of what that knob was on the front or anything that was going on. So I just dove into it by taking some of the concepts from my Showbud crossover steel and hacked apart his 67 Tele, which nowadays would be, you know, no, we don't do
thinking?
Those.
Yeah.
But that was like, that thing was only 9 years old at the time.
Absolutely. It wasn't even, yeah, exactly. You don't think of that.
So I made a Bender and it worked. It actually, I found it the other day. It's at the shop. It looks like it was made by cavemen, but it worked. And then just one thing after another, and I built a guitar to house the second one. You know, I added the first one to his old Tele, and then the second one. I was like, I'll make a guitar and I'll build this in, and I made it out of hardwood out of Padauk Vermilion, which is kind of like a rosewood. It's really hard, and nobody knew that. Certain woods sounded better than others.
Right.
And nobody knew that putting that coffee table finish on it, you know, with that you could bury a peso in, they thought that was cool. 17 coats of hand rub, you know. And I made that guitar, and it sounded terrible. And then it was just a long evolution. And about that time, I moved to Nashville and met a few critical people who were on their way somewhere. You know, everybody that I met was on their way somewhere, and that kind of ability to ride along in the wake made my career.
So, how did y'all meet?
That's an interesting question. I'm thinking Bucky Baxter might be involved in that one somehow, because I remember Bucky was a mutual friend. He worked for me for a long time. Great steel player. Worked with Steve Earle. I don't know. What did he have before me? I can't remember. Joe, did he play? I know he played with Steve Earle after me, and then Bob Dylan.
He played with.
Where did I? When he came to me, where was he? You know, was he still in Virginia?
No. He lived here. He came here with. I should have researched this.
I can't remember.
At a certain point, my recall of proper names is not what it was. It was whoever it was in Sugar. What was that band?
Oh, David Sugar.
He was working
with David Sugar. Dave Rowland.
Yeah. He was working with Dave.
That's right. David Sugar. I remember that.
I think that your gig was his big step up from that because of the fact that you were an artist.
And I was just kind of taking off and starting to have records and.
But modern, not that Dave and Sugar weren't modern, but you represented that.
No, I know what you're saying.
Cutting edge. the potential cutting edge, which people were looking for, it was not defined, but there were a few people who represented this cutting edge in a very conservative business that, you know, that wasn't going to have any of it.
So, Steve, kind of tell us where were you in your career at this point when you're meeting Joe?
We had just started taking off pretty well. I remember I just bought a bus. Yeah. That was a big deal to me because we'd been on the road. I'll back up just a little bit. Let me just digress for a second. We were struggling out on the road. I had a motor home, believe it or not. We bought a little motor home and pulled a trailer, paying the dues out there on the road. And I told the guys, I said, we're going to get to a point, we'll be getting in a bus. I wasn't even in a motor home but about a year, but we bought a bus. So that was around the time I was starting to really be on country radio, doing a lot of TV and being pretty visible. And my brother Terry playing drums, Mike Foster played keys, and myself, TK Campbell, who went on to manage Toby Keith and went on to do some awesome things down the road. We're still great friends, but he played bass and tour managed. Now we needed to add another piece to the group, so being a steel loving guy, I said, well, we need a steel player that maybe can play guitar. So Bucky came on. That's where Bucky came. And I remember, I believe that's around the first time I met Joe. I knew of you.
If your record was out, was there, was steel on the record?
Yeah, Sonny Garish played on a lot of my early records.
So most bands had what it would take to reproduce
absolutely,
the record on,
absolutely.
On the road.
Yes, and Sonny Garish was playing these mm-hmm. cool parts. Mm-hmm. And the very first stuff I did with Chet producing, Buddy Emmons played on that early stuff. And then when I went later, I started working with Tom Collins. Sonny mm-hmm. Garish was there. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, Bucky was playing a lot of those lines. Mm-hmm. And I remember you coming on the road with us and traveling with us. And we played some shows here and there, and you were with us. And my apologies. I don't remember. But if I need to say I'm sorry.
That was a great eye-opener. What was wonderful about that time I went for a few days with you guys to Texas was that it verified what I heard about the road life, which was unbelievable. but you know, it was good times. It was innocent good times. I mean, it was just really remarkable. I think people understand a little bit about what it's like to be in a band, but it is a closed culture that's pretty remarkable. But I think my recollection, Bucky introduced us. I don't know why the subject came up of the guitar and the Bender, but I think I might have already made Bucky one, and so somehow it came up, and it was a great opportunity.
Well, I can interject here and tell you what. Now I'll back up to my gig before I started making records. I played 3 years with Dottie West, played bass, and then I played when I first came to Nashville in the early 70s. And then after 3 years, I played with a great artist named Bob Luman, who was on Epic and Columbia. He made some great country records. Lonely Women Make Good Lovers was a big. He had the original big hit on that. Neither one of us wants to be the first to say goodbye. He had a big hit.
Warford played on.
That's where I was leading. Bob Warford played on some of those. He played on Lonely Women.
Yeah.
It's very, very in the background. You got to listen. But man, he played some awesome Bender stuff on that record. And he did some other. He had Billy Sanford playing a lot of stuff, but he also the Bob Warford stuff intrigued me. But he had a guy in his band. Bob Luman had a guy in his band. I played bass, but when I joined the band, he had a guy named Rip Wilson who played in his band, and he played B Bender.
Yeah.
He was a Bender player, and he loved Bob Warford, and so I really got fascinated, and I knew of B Benders through the Parsons, but with Luman and with Rip Wilson in the band playing B Benders on everything, basically, I was hooked, you know. And then here comes Joe Glazer coming along. I'm like, wow, where he's talking B Benders, and I'm going, my ears perk up. I mean, so you start talking about making guitars, and I knew you'd made Bucky one, and I'm like, Oh yeah, I want in on this.
So what kind of bender did Rip Wilson have?
He had a Parsons kind of a bender. Did you ever, Joe? You worked with him, didn't you? Yeah, I thought you did. Did you make him a bender, or did you? You probably worked on his stuff, probably.
I remember making a neck for him. I don't remember whether I did a bender for him, but very early on, when I needed the work, he came to me and had me make a neck, which later I bought back. It's one of the few things I have that I made.
Oh, wow. I didn't know about that.
Beautiful bird's eye neck. It's actually an incredible neck.
He had a telly that was I think it was a kind of a Parsons long pull, mm-hmm. B bender. And he was a big guy, funny guy, too. He was always, I remember once we did a show somewhere, and he, right before the show, he went out to set his stuff up, and he had played a Morley pedal that made his foot be up, like, really high. And I remember, there was on the front row, he went out, and he had this twin that had JBLs. It was the loudest amp I've ever heard in my life. And he went out, and I saw him kind of tweaking the angle of it. And then I looked, and there's some little old ladies on the front row, and he said, I just wanted to, I go, what are you doing? He goes, I want to make sure these were pointed right at those little ladies. You know, he was aiming it. I go, Rip.
That's awful.
He goes, I'll make sure they're going to get all this twin rerun.
Get all the highs.
So, but he was a funny, funny guy, and I learned a lot from him. And I always, anytime I only touched a bass when I was on stage. All my bass gigs, the minute I was off, I was looking for a guitar to play. With Rip, I was looking to play with his B-bender. You know, I wanted to mess with that. And so that was kind of how we hit it off.
So you were primed and ready for a B-bender. And you were building guitars as a way, almost as a vehicle for the bender in the kind of...
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, the first... You know, when I started building them, coming at it as a steel player, I thought about... What's the next step, or what's logical, or what would I like? You know, I was very influenced by my steel style was influenced by as much by Clarence White and Albert King, for that matter. You know, playing whole step blues bends as it was Emmons and Lloyd Green and Jimmy Day and stuff.
I was thinking you might have ran into Hank DeVito out there on the West Coast.
No, but I certainly got to know Hank here.
Yeah, absolutely.
But so when I the very first stuff I made. The very first guitar I made was a single pull, and then after that, I made these double pull and triple pull benders. And my patent, my original patent, which was like 79 or whenever it was a down and out, and then an in. It had a paddle on the back that you could pull against your belly, and it dropped the low E like on the C6,
yeah.
Where you go
all the way down there. Yeah.
Major third, minor third. Which is what's interesting about it is that, and I did this I did well before I moved here, and to get it to stay in tune, the low E thing, to come back, I figured out I had to lock it down at the nut. So I made a locking nut.
Wow.
A one string locking nut. Which, when I got around to patenting all this stuff, my attorney said, well, what about that thing? You know, pointing at the locking nut. I said, oh, that's nothing. That's no... And that turned out to be a huge mistake, because the whole Floyd Rose Kaler...
Busted wide open, right?
Well, they got into this huge legal battle.
Oh.
And a lot of it came down to... Because everything else had been done by Mose Wright or something else, except the locking nut, which Floyd Rose got credit for. But I think I predated that.
That's unreal.
Which... If it were true, and if I had the foresight to patent it, which I didn't, it might have been of significance. You know?
Yeah.
I might not be having to ride a bicycle today as much as I can have a car.
And Joe, you remember we talked about, I remember talking to you about a Strat. You know, I said, what about a B-bender on a Strat? You know, I thought that was an intriguing, because you'd only seen them on tallies, you know. And I remember us talking about that. That was the first one you made me, was actually a Strat.
And maybe the first Strat. I mean, I don't know, but I think that may have been the first Strat I ever put a bender on.
Yeah. Have you done many since?
I've done we now do a few a day, you know, and maybe of the 50 or 60 or whatever it is per month, maybe one or two of them is a Strat. Maybe one is a Strat. So it's not very many, but it's doable, not on a Strat that's got a vibrato on it, but certainly on a hardtail. And there's no reason not.
Absolutely. I was always, you know, Ryan, my son Ryan and I were talking this morning, actually, and he said, Dad, you know, because people kind of associate you with a telly, but he goes, you really are a Strat guy. And I think he's right in a lot of ways, because I've played, my brother Terry is a total Strat geek. You know, he's always been a Strat guy, and I played his 60 Strat on the road. Well, Robbie, when you were with us, I was playing his 60 Strat. And then Paul Yandel made me I had a T60 that was kind of a Frankenstein guitar that he made into a, it was really a Strat kind of sounding guitar. It was a PVT60. But, so that was, and then when you made my B-Bender, I went to a Strat, so. I've always really been a Strat guy, I guess is what I'm saying. So,
yeah. All right. So now we have the Strat in question. So you were just talking about the fact that you were kind of more of a Strat player. And so how did this come about? Did you ask Joe about, you know, building this? What happened?
I think on our between that road trip we speak of and just being around each other through our friend Bucky, we just kind of started talking, you know, hey, how about making me a Strat, Joe? You know, I kind of hit him up and a guitar, and then I think it went to Strat at some point.
You certainly had this by the time that road trip happened.
But yeah, I was wondering the timing on that.
I think we met somewhere and had a conversation about it.
Like, I think we did too. And then I said, how about a Strat? Yeah. What do you think about that?
And so this was the first Strat you did with a Bender, correct?
Oh, I'm pretty sure. I mean, I did some after this, but I can't be 100% sure of that, because I did one for Harry Robinson at one point, a double, but I don't know.
I never seen one. I'll say that. I never seen one till this.
I think this was probably the idea that it was the custom color headstock is interesting. I was very much educated by Bill Hullett. Do you know Bill Hullett?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
When I first moved to town, he was to my education what John Abraham was in California, hipping me to stuff that they'd been obsessed with for a long time already. And I don't remember where. I know you said you wanted it bright red.
Yep. And I remember that.
I went to the paint store and mixed my own paint. I went looked through the catalogs. I went through the catalogs looking for Fiesta Red and all that stuff. And because there was a store in Franklin that still had some of the old Duco colors on a shelf. They weren't using them. And they had the catalogs. And you could look these things up, and they still had the Fender name. Like the Fender didn't change the name when they took these car colors. And I looked up Fiesta Red, and I took out anything that was dark. So, you know, like a lot of car colors, they look like they're bright red, but they got black in them and brown.
Candy apple-y kind of.
Yeah, just they mix six or seven colors in, and some of them were dark. And I took them out. And when I got around to your telly, I took out even more of them. I mean, it was just like red and orange and a little white, and that was it. Trying to get as bright as possible, but that's where that came from. I remember that.
I remember, too, Joe, that right there was a young guy making pickups out in California named Seymour Duncan, and I met him through Chet. I was working with Chet. Mm-hmm. We played Santa Barbara. I remember him coming out and bringing Paul Rivera, you know, came too, and mm-hmm. I met him at that time. And I remember Seymour and I hit it off, mm-hmm. and I was like, oh, I want these pickups, you know, and then also Paul Yandel got involved with this mm-hmm. guitar member. He was very adamant about the Ebony. My friend and longtime Chet guy, you know, that I worked, my bandmate. And so Paul was one of those guys. He was very adamant about what he saw, his vision of this. But I think part of that might have been I wanted this inlay. I really, mm-hmm. and I think it was partly because it would be striking. More because of the visual of it, wouldn't you think?
I don't know, you know, Paul, he came, I believe, to my shop and announced that this was going to be Ebony fingerboard. And I remember telling him that I had had experiences with like the first guitar I made for Olander had an ebony fingerboard, and it did not help the sound. And I had a couple other experiences with ebony on Telecaster, Fender stuff, and realized that it was too bright. The first, you know, one of the very first people, so Olander and Jerry Gowan were the first two guys who I built for here, and those were heavy kind of exotic wood guitars, which was a thing then. You know, people were building with a lot of exotic woods.
What year would that be?
80, 81 probably. It is the very first stuff I made here, and somehow I figured out pretty quickly that was a dead end. That exotic, you know, hardwood bodies. I stumbled on this actually. I went to the hardware store to buy something to be able to put together and take apart so I could test a new Bender thing. And it turned out to be ash, and it turned out to be lightweight ash. I don't know that I did this on purpose, but it was so-called swamp ash. Mm. And I bought it in the hardware store. And I put the guitar together to test the Bender, I believe. And the thing sounded so much better than what I was building. I was like, that's interesting. So I'll just finish it off. And so I painted it, and it sounded less good. And I thought, oh, man, what's that mean? I stripped it off. I mean, I had all the time in the world. I lived in this farm out in Leaper's Fork. You know, I barely made any living, but I was playing steel, so I barely made any living. So I stripped it off again. This is just crazy. And it sounded great again. So it's like, okay, mental note. Lots of finish kills the sound. And nobody knew anything about this. And then I tried that with a harder wood body I had around. It still sounded terrible. And I've also with the fingerboards, I started to realize that the fingerboard impacted the sound. By this time I knew it, and I tried to talk Paul out of the ebony. He just, you know, listen, Junior, you know, and that's the way it was.
Remember, jumping in on you, Joe, but I remember there's a brilliant artist, a lady named Diane Patrick, that did this inlay. And my idea was to incorporate my initials, but do it very inconspicuously. And so she came up with this little tree of life that I love it. But if you look closely, you can see the SW right there. And so anyway, beautiful. And then immediately, right as soon as you handed this to me, finished, we did I had a song out called Why Goodbye that we did a video on it. And videos were just starting to be coming in vogue at that time. I think in country, I'd only seen the Judds had one and somebody else. I mean, there aren't very many videos. They just weren't a thing yet in country. And we did this video. We rented a motel, in Antioch, and painted the whole front of the building. And this I did it using the video, and I got so much response from it. Of course, it was real flashy. Great guitar for a video, you know. So. Yeah.
The matching headstock, was that your idea or was that Steve's?
I don't remember that.
I mean, it was a thing.
I don't even remember.
Anybody who was a Fender fanatic, which I'm sure both of us were, would want that. Yeah, would want that.
Like that white bass. It's, yeah, that the matching head, you know.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean,
not sure either.
At that point.
Ryan, I love it. My son Ryan calls it the redhead. You know, he says, hey, grab that redhead. He used to always, when he was younger, he would call it the redhead.
Yeah.
I had the logo figured out by then, which is basically a total ripoff of a Fender logo.
It's the same that's hand script. Done too, right?
Yeah, that's hand painted, which is crazy because I'd have to lay down the painter.
You did that yourself too, right? Yeah. Wow!
You have to lay down the black and then put the silver on top of it. You messed it up. Come back. I mean, my eyes probably aren't good enough, and my hands probably not steady enough to do that anymore. But I did quite a number of guitars hand painted, and that wasn't my first logo. So that's pretty early, but not. But there was a completely different logo that was more angular that was preceded that.
And earlier you were mentioning you hadn't figured out the wood thing. So tell us about the wood thing. You started looking at the neck and
fairly early on, I had met Paul Reed Smith, and Paul and I were both kind of beginning to build. And he called me up one day and said, man, for my first 7 guitars or 14 guitars, I forget which it is, I'm looking for some humbucking pickups that I can rewind. He wanted to do his own wind. And because I knew people who knew people and stuff, I got a hold of, I hate to say this because this is probably not appropriate, but the statute of limitations are passed. But somebody had a bunch of rejected Gibson pickups. Maybe they were had a failed coil or something. And I stripped the, I said, oh, Paul, no problem. And I really, you know, I just wanted to be helpful. And so I found these things, stripped the wire off of them so that it would look like they were just, like I had the power to get to just the bobbins and stuff. And I sent them to him and he said, well, okay, thank you so much. I'm going to give you my most closely guarded secret, the wood guy. And this was for his first 7 or 14 guitar. I mean, the number was 14, whether it was for 7 guitars or whether it was 28 for 14 guitars, I don't remember, but his first batch. And so he turned me on to this guy who was his secret wood guy for a long time and now is a known, guy who was his wood source. And I went up and visited that guy and he got me to a completely different grade of Curly Maple. Very few people were using Curly Maple. Obviously Gibson had in the 50s, but Phil Kubicki was, Paul was, maybe nobody else. And I was using it because from being a Showbud steel guitar owner, they used Birdseye and Curly Maple, and I was fascinated by it. And so this looks like the older stuff that I was able to find just by going to lumber yards and looking at the stuff that they were throwing away because nobody wanted that stuff. It wasn't, you know, it's too hard to work. You couldn't run it through a planer without it chipping out and stuff. They didn't want it.
Joe, talk about these for a moment, if you don't mind, these little markers. I don't know if you can see those, but they're actually two pieces, right? If you can see it, it's they're like a half moon or a moon, but black on the bottom and ebony and I guess mother of pearl or whatever that is.
I think it was some creative idea I had. I think it was based on the Harlequin mask, that half black, half white Harlequin mask.
I love them. They're very easy to see. And as I said off camera, as I've gotten older with my eyesight, I really like them a lot now.
It wasn't easy to do. I remember... you know, I had my whole life to finish a guitar. It didn't occur to me that there was a connection between how long something took and how much food you would have consumed in the meantime and how broke you'd be when you were done. I mean, I was really a go-to-the-grocery-store guy, buy milk or yogurt, but not both. I mean, it was really lean for my first 10 years here.
Wow.
But I liked the idea of doing that. I had never seen that. I just thought it would look cool, and I think it does look cool. In retrospect, I like it a lot.
Would you do it again?
I won't build a guitar again. Next lifetime.
So the answer is no.
The answer is no. How much of this was hand, like the pick guard? Did you hand make that?
Absolutely. Okay. And that's celluloid, which you could get then. Absolutely all handmade. Even the bender, you can see I made myself on the workbench. I mean, it looks like it was made with a hammer and a hacksaw. And then had it plated. There was a place called Leonard Plating, which is still here, and I would take these two or three pieces down, and they would plate
them. Wow.
I'm sure I made the plate, and I punched. Well, let's see what this says. It's serial number 43, U.S. patent number on it. So I started at 29, at serial number 29, because I didn't want anybody to know was just starting. So there's no 1 through 28.
So you pushed in on that.
Yeah. So that, maybe this was about the, if I was accurate, this was maybe about the 12th or 14th guitar I made, period.
Yeah.
And that I was putting the patent number on means that the patent had issued.
Joe, did you do this? Or I don't even recall. Yeah. Do you recall, is that like a...
Probably for turning the neck pickup on with the bridge pickup.
So I don't even recall. I thought those are things you think you'll never forget, but time does that to you, I guess. But
I think it was so you could get that two pickup tele sound, but it could also have been to split to split these stacks, because stacks were great. The Seymour Duncan stacks were great pickups. This one is older than these. So I think this one is original because the magnet is under the cover.
Yeah.
When they first came out, they had red covers and nobody liked that.
Yeah, I remember that.
So I think they were probably all these, and then when this is probably something we swapped in later.
Yeah. Gotcha.
Yeah, it's unique. It's hilarious to see it.
Yeah.
You know, it's been a huge, this was a huge break for me. You know, that my early guys, you and Skaggs and stuff, absolutely put me on the map. And so, had that not happened.
Well, I think we would say that too. It's kind of both ways, you know.
So this changed your guitar sound, because all of a sudden the B bender came into your arsenal.
Yep. And I started thinking of that when we made records, you know, and I was lucky that I was working with Nora Wilson and Tony Brown producing my records. And I love it that they got it, you know, because Tony would say, you know, either he would or I would, I'm playing this solo, or you need to play this solo. And so I was thinking in terms of my songwriting. I'd been writing a lot, but I was getting a few cuts that I would write, you know, but later I would really be cutting a lot of my stuff. But at that point, I'm looking for stuff, you know. Some Fools Never Learn came along, and I'm like, oh yeah, I'm doing a Bender solo on that, and played it on this guitar. And you know, Tony was so great that he was, and Bowen too, you know, they would say, yeah, you go do that. You know, they were pushing me to, and that wasn't always the case back in those days, you know, let the studio, session guys play it, you
absolutely.
Know, you do it on the road, but let these, you know, I'm like, no, I really want to, well,
because
this, and Paul Yandel, pardon me, Paul Yandel was huge on that. You know, I have to give him so much credit, my buddy Paul, because I remember him going to producers and going like, this kid needs to play his own guitar stuff, dude, come on, you know. I heard him say that to some producers, you know. So
the standard at that point would have been for you just to sing.
Absolutely.
And even if you did play, it'd be a situation where you sang during the tracking, and then you would, and then it was a privilege for you to get to overdub your solo and other guitar parts.
Well, I'll say I was lucky, man. Coming into making records right out of the chute, I was with Chet. You know, Chet made those first records. So right from the get-go, you know, Chet, of course, was going like, get out there. Even when I was like, whoa, you know, in front of all these great players, Chet would go, here, go play this. He really pushed me to do it. So that's, I'm lucky.
It also came at a time when there was a new breed of player artists. And even though there are people like Ronnie Millsap who did that because they had to back themselves up to some extent, it was unusual. And it also wasn't traditional. And so, not that Nashville was union run, but there was sort of the A-team kind of thing, like, you do what you do, we do what we do.
We got this.
Yeah. And we're not going to mix that. And please don't step on us. We won't step on you.
Well, but, as a kid coming up, Joe, for me now, from my point of view, you're talking about Stu Guitar. Now, here's my point of view on that. I came up talking about your influences with your parents. My dad had country bands and played and was a tremendous musician and singer. Worked, had a regular job, but so I came up listening to Jerry Bird records. Mm-hmm. My dad loved Jerry Bird, steel players. He had steels in our house. My dad had lap steels and pedal. When pedals came along, I remember having a little multi-chord steel in
our
house.
You're not old enough for that.
I was 10. I was 8. I was a little bitty guy. But my dad had them. I remember seeing a multi-chord steel going like, what the hell is that thing? You know, remember the pedals came out the
side right.
Like a piano and like only on the side. But I was listening to later, you're saying James Burton and then all the Bob Warford we talked about. I remember hearing those Ronstadt records and just going crazy. Oh my God, who's playing? Who is that? You know,
well, Albert Lee, you can't leave the second generation of these, the sort of younger generation, and Ray Flack, who didn't play using a Bender, but you wouldn't have known.
Oh, he was a tremendous player, man.
And he was, that style was, I think he would agree that it was based on stuff that had happened because there were Benders.
Because of a Bender, yeah.
But, you know, there were a few guys. But even a person like Jerry Reed, who was a tremendous instrumentalist when he became an artist.
Glenn Campbell and Jerry Reed. That's where I was going. Glenn Campbell and Jerry Reed. That's, I would look at that stuff and watch them and go, that's what I want to do right there. I mean, look at that. I saw Glenn Campbell in my sophomore year of high school. I went to the Indiana State Fair and Glenn Campbell, his Good Time Hour was, but I was like, oh my God, I had great seats, about 12 rows back, right in the center. And the opening act was Jerry Reed. And he had Paul Yandel played with him, and he had Larry London played drums, and Steve Shaver played bass. Wow. And I remember seeing that and going like, and then a few years later, I'm playing with Paul in Chet's band. It's crazy, you know, can't make it up.
Yeah. So this is the guitar that also used on Midnight Fire.
Yep.
Yeah, and I remember seeing, like, there's clips of the award show where you're playing this guitar.
Where I messed up. I think I skidded across a couple notes.
That's
on that.
That's great that you remember.
I remember this Music City News Awards. Yeah. I remember walking out going, damn it. I didn't play that one little section clean as I could. I'd done it 1,000 times, but you get nervous when that tux goes on, you know.
Yeah, you were wearing a tux. So, Joe, how did it affect you when people saw Steve playing this guitar? Did people start making, I mean, because you don't have the internet or anything like that, so people had to kind of figure out, what is that? They probably thought it was a Fender or...
They had to go ask somebody. Yeah. And so they either asked you or they asked Bucky or somebody.
And I would always say, oh, no, this is, you know. I remember so many times bands would come up, opening bands, they would come up and be looking, going, you know, they really wanted to see this guitar. You know, because I was doing a lot of TV back then, and so whenever I'd do a show, it was funny watching players. Yeah. You knew who the players were; they were wanting to get up close to this. You know.
It was a word of mouth deal.
Yeah.
The downside was that 5,000 people couldn't find out in 4 minutes.
You know?
But the upside was that anybody who went to the trouble to find out was serious. This was just like playing anyway.
It's like,
the odds were so great against me, for instance, finding a steel, learning to play, figuring out who was on records, you know, all this kind of stuff. The odds were stacked against you. So if you went to do it, you already had to be determined, or you had to learn to be determined. So people who'd call me up about this, they already were pretty
on fire.
Pretty on fire. And the upside was it, like I said, it put me on the map. The downside was they wanted the exact same thing, and I'm not a guy who does that for
all. That was the question. So did you get requests to build an identical?
You bet. And I wouldn't do it. I came close to building the Red Telly. There's a couple of them out there that are that, you know, but I didn't want to do this, especially because of not because I was prejudiced against the ebony, but because the inlay was personal, the guitar was personal. I didn't really want to do a lot of strats because I don't know why, reason.
Gotcha.
And but people would want that, you know, and they would want whoever's guitar over and over again. And when I mixed these colors, I did it standing in the paint shop, a little of the, like an improvising Julia shop.
A little of this, a little of that.
And it's like when Ricky played that purple guitar on Live in London, and I started getting calls about that. It's like, I can't make that purple again. So I'd go back in there and I'd mix it. And God knows what they look like side by side, you know, but I didn't want to do it. So, yeah, I wasn't interested in making the same guitar.
Yeah. I always love Ricky and I remember laying these guitars together and looking at them both, the Telly and his purple. They kind of came out of the same batch of wood and stuff, didn't they, Joe, probably?
They certainly at this.
They were brothers, kind of like.
They were early brothers at the point that I had learned how do you really get a decent sound. Like, you can see that the finish on this wasn't very thick. This is the Hullet. He didn't specifically say, make the finish thinner, but when I was looking at what he and a few other people considered to be great guitars, there was not much finish on it. And even though they weren't relics, they were built to look like be ready to be worn and torn. And so this and Ricky's guitar and two or three others were the very, maybe this and Ricky's were probably the first of those thin finished real instruments.
Yeah. Ryan, I keep mentioning him, my son Ryan, but he knows more about my stuff than I do, so I always defer to him. But he had a good point too. My Telly actually, I always had people say, your Telly is less Telly than, it's more Strat than Telly, because I played kind of that we had a five-way kind of, I kind of played it in a Strat-ish sound. And Ryan pointed out, he goes, yeah, because you're a Strat guy. You know, he goes, even you've been playing a Strat for so many years when you go to that telly. I didn't play on the back bridge pickup a ton, you know. I did some, but mostly was the kind of in between the middle and back.
Well, that was a, you know, Strats were a dominant part of the country music. You know, Nashville, in a way, this is beautiful about Nashville, but also a little bit of the dark side. Nashville always wants to be what it's not. It wants to be what somebody else is, which is the way we all are. And even when I moved here in 79, it was trying to be pop.
Oh, yeah.
And the players were trying to be
pop. They were chasing it.
They were chasing it. And they had lost affection for, we all want to be something, you know. But instead of the, and maybe it's arguable that the telly never was a big part of Nashville sound, that it was
more Bakersfield. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
But when I moved here, it was about 335s, and it was about Strats through a heavy chorus, the Pete Wade kind of thing. And that Strat sound was really important. And I stumbled on the idea, on the fact, Chet had something to do with this. I didn't know him very well, but at one point, I took a Dan Electro and put the middle pickup on rails because I was trying to, I don't know what I was trying to figure out. But I realized that if you put a bridge pickup in and you put the middle, where the pickup was, I realized that where the pickup was had everything to do with how it sounded. And I called Seymour and he said, well, it's got a lot to do with the, you know, the Strat pickups. We remagnetized the blah, blah, blah. And, cause I was trying to figure out what that sound was.
Yeah.
And you know, you're never the first person who knows something. There's some guy in Sri Lanka who stumbled on this before I did, you know, or you know, on Mars. But so I took this pickup and I moved it, trying to figure out. I think it was when I started to do. God, I don't know why it was, but I moved the middle pickup. And I noticed it sounded radically different as it got that when it got to the neck position, it sounded like a neck pickup, and when it was in the middle position, it sounded like a middle pickup. It's like, who knew? And Chet, I had this Dan Electro I was messing around with. Chet, for some reason, I think it was at Corner Music, was in and looked at it and said, oh, well, there's something I want to do. I want a guitar where I can move that pickup around, because he already knew. He knew, you know, of course he knew, you know. And he dicked around with enough of his guitars.
He wanted to be like a sliding
thing. He wanted to be able to put the sound where he wanted to put it.
Yeah.
And so I made a guitar that had these rails. I don't know what ever happened to it. Where you could slide either one or two pickups. And that immediately led me to the idea that you could put the middle pickup and get the Strat sound, put it in a telly. And Sid Hudson, who I don't know if you remember
I
him.
Do.
But he was, I think, the first guy who came to me and said, I want one guitar. I can go to these club gigs. I can get the Strat sound that everybody is living on, but I can put a humbucker in the neck. Then I don't have to take my 335. And then let's build it around a telly, because there's some stuff where a telly is important.
Smart.
And so I built this three pickup telly. And again, somewhere, I think McAdam had built one. You know, people have done this, but nobody had a thing. You know, it was not a thing. And it quickly became a thing in Nashville. And Sid Hudson and then Brent Mason.
Mm-hmm.
And so figuring out that the middle pickup gave that sound, it then became a big challenge to try to, because the back pickup is at a different angle on a telly than the Strat. It's a different relationship to the bridge. How do you optimize that? And so figuring out, that had a lot to do with figuring out that these stacks had a rich two pickup Strat sound. So all that stuff evolved together. Based on trying to make a Telecaster have a believable Strat sound. And you were the great Petri dish for this, because it was a big part of your sound. And getting that to where it was convincing. By the time I made the red guitar, I was really focusing on what do you have to do with the pickup? Because the back pickup's in a metal plate, so you can't really change that. What do you have to do with the middle pickup? And there's a tiny little zone where it sounds great. And certain pickups in the stacks, I stumbled on the fact that even though this is two coils, it's a humbucker. They built it as a humbucker so it would hum cancel, that the lower pickup being further away from the strings is weak and muddy, which is okay as a system, but it kept the middle pickup from sounding as great as it could. And so we quickly just abandoned the use of the bottom pickup and the hum canceling in order to use just the top coil as that combination. And to this day, it's the best. Mm. It still is. It's just accidental. So all that stuff was evolving, blah, blah, blah.
Talking about Chet with the Strat, I'll tell you a quickie. A very daunting task that I had once. I produced a record called No More Mr. Nice Guy. It was the first record that I produced. I had to really talk my label into doing it. They really didn't want me to do it. But anyway, I had a lot of guests on it, from Larry Carlton to Chet, and a lot of my pals and friends, and Vince came and played. And so, but I went over. Chet was going to play on this tune I wrote called Big Hero, Little Hero. And which I wrote about Chet, you know. There was a guy in Atlanta, a guy used to call when I played in the band. He called Chet Big Hero and me Little Hero. So I kind of wrote it with that. And so anyway, I go over Chet's. My idea in my mind was for Chet to play as Del Vecchio. I heard this on this particular song. So I walk in and Chet's all ready to go. I go in with my engineer, Randy Gardner. I look through the window and Chet's got a white Strat in his hands. And he was playing a Strat, and I'm thinking, I don't want Chet playing a Strat. You know, how do I say this and get that Strat out of his hands and get him on the Del Vecchio? But you just don't associate Chet's sound with a Strat, do you? I mean, you just don't think of that.
Was that his friendship with Knopfler that maybe put
probably,
that in his?
Probably. Mm-hmm. I played on that record with Knopfler. I played bass on three or four tracks, I think, and it was quite an experience, you know, working, playing on that stuff.
Wow.
I think. But anyway, yeah, I think might have been he was had Strat on his brain,
and he was so open-minded.
Absolutely,
he was just one of these guys who was, you could say, tinkering, but he was constantly looking for that other little thing.
Would try anything too, you know.
Pat Bergerson told me that Pat had one of those little plastic Boss pedal boards full of pedals, and that when he started playing with Chet, the first thing Chet did was take notes on what pedals he had, and he bought all the same pedals just to check them out and see if it was something that would work for him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he was very. You're right. He was very curious, very interested in everything, and aware of everything. Anything you had, he was checking it out and was very curious and very aware.
Even something like the Del Vecchio, which is it's a resonator that was, it's a Brazilian-made resonator. They weren't particularly...
Not well made, right?
No, I mean, not particularly, but they had a certain sound. I mean, he found that. He found a sound for it. I think he was really the first person that influenced everybody else to get them.
Absolutely.
One thing about the fingerboard on this... is that Chet had the Del Vecchios. I think these guys in the Del Vecchio factory were sitting on the floor putting fret slots in wherever they thought the next one ought to be,
That looks good.
And the frets are so random, and probably nobody ever noticed this until it got here. And tuning was an issue. And the Chet's, I don't know who did the first one, but Paul had the fingerboards replaced with this ebony fingerboard. And I remember at some point when one of the times I got to hang out with Chet, Chet handed me his Del Vecchio and said, "You put this fingerboard on." And I said, "I don't think I didn't. Thanks, but I didn't." And I think Jerry Jones did correct the fret placement because it was a problem. We did move, and I know I didn't do it because what we would do is just fill the slots and put the frets where they ought to be. Because of the sound impact of ebony. And so part of my whole prejudice against ebony on instruments isn't that ebony doesn't sound good. It just changes the sound. Yeah. And you get what you get. And if you want to keep a guitar, an instrument sounding the same, or if you're building an instrument, you think, like in my early days, it's like, what's an perfect instrument? Curly maple neck, nice thick piece of ebony, blah, blah, blah. You know, if you're menu building an instrument, you're not likely to get something predictable. You're going to get some combination of things. You know, instruments just are what they are, and something that worked on a Les Paul or worked on a D'Angelico won't work on a 335 or a Les Paul. Every little bit makes a big difference.
Do you know the story of the Del Vecchio, just briefly, where Chet got the Del Vecchio? He befriended Los Indios Tabajaras.
That's right.
You know the story, I guess, Zach, you know.
Yeah,
and, and I met Nato Lima once. I met him with Chet. Brilliant. He were brilliant composers and from the rainforest. I mean, totally played these classical players that came out of the rainforest of Brazil, and just they were on Carson a lot. They would be on Johnny Carson, and but they were brilliant classical players, composers. Nato, I think he's the one that wrote Blue Angel, and but anyway, that's and so I think Chet had been around those guys and recorded with them, and that's where he kind of latched onto the Del Vecchio.
One last thing on this guitar before we move on to the Red Bender. What is the body wood on this?
Let's look at the back. Fortunately, you've worn enough off. That's alder.
Okay.
It's alder.
So alder.
Because you can see. You know, one thing I loved about your use of these guitars is that you beat the crap out of them. And you didn't care.
I threw them.
It doesn't matter. That was so, because people are so precious about stuff. You know, you excavated your way through to the front side on the telly. And that was such an honor, as opposed to this thing of trying to keep something.
Worship thing.
Yeah.
But that red, the telly, I remember my guitar tech, Tommy Webb, his dad drove bus for me, Curtis. We called him Don't Hurt Us, Curtis. And, but Tommy, one of my dear friends, we got into this thing where every night I would toss my telly to him. I'd throw it to him. I know people do that, but it was just kind of, I did it one night, and then it became a thing. And so every night I would toss it, and I started backing up every night just a little bit see how he would chase it. And it got to be where finally he came to me. We just go, we got to quit.
Yeah.
Cause we did it for 8 months where I would throw it from here to that wall. I'd take the strap and the band's playing the chaser off and I would take it. It had a wireless and everything. I'd just take it and throw it. I'd had it down though where I threw it where it went up. And when it came down, he just caught it like that. And he was a real athletic kid, you know, but finally we go, you know, I better not be doing that anymore. If something happened to this thing, I don't even have a backup, you know.
You know, speaking of your live thing, and when I went out took this little 3-day road trip with you guys to Fort Worth or wherever it was, the first gig, I sort of wandered around out in the audience. You guys did the coolest, most sophisticated thing. You were singing, I forget what song it was, but at one point while singing it, you would just kind of turn away in the middle of the lyric, turn away from the mic and look, you know, at something else. And your vocal would go on completely.
Going, yeah.
And I was like, this guy's singing the tracks. What? You know, and it was you and your brother who's playing drums. Who sounded exactly the same. You had this, where this came from is probably like your teenage years playing in your dad's band.
Yeah, we had it down, man, too.
It was, and so I thought, did I just see that, or am I having am I losing it? And I watched and watched, and you go quite a while, through the set, and then you did it again. It's like, okay, I saw that. That's Terry.
I'm giving it away. We almost did it like a ventriloquist where I would go, lots of times, lonely, you know, that we would do it. We had it down. To every little section. We had it down. I did it.
But it was aimed at only the most perceptive person in the audience. Kind of like you'd go to a gig and you're listening to, wow, the bass drum has a certain, you know, it's like for these geeks who know what the hell is going on in the first place. Cause most people go and they don't know whether the band's in tune, if it's in time, you know, whether the players are any good. And this was so aimed at that tiny slice of people.
It was for us as much as them, you know.
That was incredible.
Oh, that's funny.
All right, we're back with
look at this guy.
Yeah. So this has been kind of your constant companion since you got it.
Yeah.
I mean, it's hard to think of a, you know, there's not that many performances where you don't have this guitar.
Yeah. No question. But boy, look at how pronounced that's become over the years, that beautiful wood. I mean, that stripe.
Yeah. We were talking about that, the era of the neckwood and the Strat and this is the post Paul Reed Smith
conversation.
Wood source.
And you know, Ricky's purple guy looks, they're so similar.
It is the same tree, I believe.
Yeah, when I see his, I just go, oh my God, that's mine. You know,
I drove up to New England to go get wood, and we would go to these little mills, and they were cutting maple, and they were taking the curly stuff and throwing it to the side to use to chip, I suppose, because nobody wanted it again. Mm-hmm. And we went through these piles. I didn't, at this point, really still understand the hardness, stiffness, significance in necks, that the mass and the stiffness, the modulus elasticity had a lot to do with the sound. So I bought a lot of different curly maple, and it wasn't until I came back down here and started building with it that I realized that some necks sounded much better than others. And there was this one, but I was smart enough, I was lucky enough that when I was buying it, I would take a magic marker and write on the end of the boards what came from a particular thing. We sat at this mill and picked up all this wood, and this particular tree, I had a red magic marker, and I wrote, I think, the date on it. And this turned out to be just the magic sounding neckwood of any of that batch I got.
Did it come from Vermont, or do you remember where?
Moncton, Maryland.
Moncton, yeah, Maryland.
So what was it that made these special as far as that you're talking about the mass and the flexibility and all that?
Well, you know, we were, you know, like I said earlier, the type of finish, the thickness of the finish, the weight of the body, every single one of these things affects the sound of a guitar, whether it's a single or a double truss rod. I mean, I always used single truss rods like Fender, a curved truss rod, and tried to make it so that when it was finished, that it was tight. You know, I would build bow into the neck so I could tighten it out because it affects the sound. And some of it unpredictably, and certainly the body wood. This is basswood, by the way, which I didn't use a lot, but I think I was experimenting with. But all that stuff has a lot to do with the sound of an instrument. And some of it's a mysterious combination of things, but some of it's fairly predictable.
So how did this guitar come about? So
you know what, Joe, if you remember, if I'm not mistaken, this guitar you started making in 86, mm-hmm. and the guys in the band all got together and said, let's have this guitar made for Steve. That's really how it started, because I think they may have heard me on the road, on the bus. They may have heard me saying, like, I think I'm going to have a Tele made, or they may have heard me, in my mind, I'm thinking they may have heard me say something. And I think behind my back, they all went to you and said, let's make a Tele. Well, at some point, obviously, I got to be involved because the color and the specs of it. And then I was. But I think that's where the impetus was, the band got this for me.
Yeah.
And I used to get together with whoever I was building for and go over neck shape, because I was hand shaping these things, mm-hmm. actually on the bottom side of a belt sander. This is the most dangerous, crazy thing. But I would take the neck and I would, you know, a belt sander goes around like that. And the top of it's on a flat plate of platen is what it's called, and the bottom's just this flapping piece of sanding belt going by at 40 miles an hour. I would reach my hand under it and use it as a stroke sander and shape the neck.
Yeah, yeah.
And try to do it around something that either a neck you showed me that you liked or something. Somehow we came, and then I would make a little template. So this may have been a copy of the neck on
that. Yeah, I remember that discussion, but I don't remember where it came from. But I remember that it was like, oh, yeah, that's what I want, you know, the curvature. And I don't know if there's another Tele I had or something.
You might have showed me something in the first place. And this is a real decal at this point.
Gone to a decal.
Yeah. And
yeah.
And did you have templates for the headstock shape?
I made templates from all the stuff, yeah.
And what was it based on? Was it based on vintage instruments that you had?
It was probably based on, it could have been based on Bill Hullett's guitar, because I took that apart at one point, weighed the body and the neck. Yeah. At a certain point, I realized that building at random didn't get you anywhere, and that, that the body weight mattered. Again, nobody knew this stuff. Nobody knew any of this stuff. Right. And I started weighing the great sounding guitars, and then weighing the body and the neck, and tapping on them and listening to what their resonant frequency was. I realized that certain combinations sounded superior. That, and about that, about the time I really dialed it in, I quit building, which would have been the early 90s. But there was absolutely an important correlation there. And so at the point when I was studying that, I took Hullett's guitar apart with his knowledge, weighed it all, and other ones, and made the templates as faithful to Fenders as possible. On this one, it doesn't have this little lip. For some reason on the Strats, the early ones, I put a lip on that side of the neck that Fender didn't put on. I don't know what I was thinking, but this became much more faithful to the Fender.
At some point, you started doing these a little not less wide than a Tele, right? I mean, this is not as thick as a Tele.
Yeah, and the reason is because it was hard to get the wood of, you know, to buy alder or basswood. I could get it in 3/4 thickness and glue it together,
yeah,
or whatever it was. But also, I was building the bender into these. I later figured out how to drill a hole through them without doing this. But the early ones, I built them in, and so it's a top and a bottom, a front and a back glued together.
Glued, yeah,
and that's why when glued 3/4 and 3/4, it didn't add up to 1 3/4, which is what a Fender is. So as much as I'd like to claim that I did it on purpose, I did it because there was no choice.
Sure. So this has a seam like mid-body?
Yeah, there's a seam in there mid-body, yeah.
Yeah.
The binding, is that, I don't recall, is that me idea or you idea?
I've always loved the single front binding.
Me too.
I think we talked about this.
I couldn't remember, but uh-huh. I'm so glad we did it on uh-huh. this guitar, though, that white uh-huh. binding, you know.
I thought, you know, I love the Fender. Early on, I realized how classic and beautiful the Fender stuff was up through the mid-60s. I mean, as time went on, we allow later and later stuff. But my first instrument I put a Bender in, which I ended up with, was a 67 Tele. I always put the wall in there, and after that, like, who cares? Or 68, you know, who cares? Before that, everything was some sort of religious icon, and I loved the customs that Fender did. They did binding. I don't know if they ever did a single front only binding, but I loved that idea. And so I built a number of guitars like this. And I think you and I talked about this.
I think we did too. We both flipped. I mean, we were both had a crush on it. You know, the interesting thing is, for me, I tell people this, and they can't. It freaks people out really a little bit. But I never owned a guitar until I was till sophomore in high school. I never owned a guitar. Having played my dad's, you know, he had a Jazzmaster, so mm-hmm. I was always a real Fender guy. I played a Jazzmaster and pretended in my mind that it was a Tele, you know. I'd play all those Roy Nichols licks and Burton licks, acting in my brain I was playing a Tele, you know.
Why did you use, Klusen type machine heads?
Joe.
Early on, again, I was under the influence of the fact that everything newer was better. Like the first few guitars had Schallers and stuff. Maybe that does.
Yes.
I think
it does. Yeah, yeah.
I think Paul prescribed Schallers for that.
I think so, too.
But fairly quickly, again, I learned that by retrofitting tuners, and here's the guitar, and then we put on these better tuners, and suddenly there was something wrong with the guitar. And I've always believed that less is better, and you don't change something unless there's a really good reason. But it started to become apparent. You know, somebody bring a guitar and they go, "I want Grovers or Schallers on this." We play it ahead of time. I'm like the worst guitar player in the world, but I can hear what instruments sound like, and I'd play the thing. And say, this is a great sounding guitar. And we'd put Schallers on somebody's guitar. It's like, wow. We shouldn't have done that. Mm-hmm. And then you can't really necessarily tell people so pretty quickly we were recommending, or I guess I was working mostly by myself. It's like, very few problems with tuning comes from the tuners. In fact, in reality, tuners have to be incredibly bad. As long as you're tuning up from below the note, they have to be incredibly bad to affect the ability of a guitar to stay in tune. And so
it's usually the nut.
Yeah, it's the nut. Yeah. Or if you tune down, then the slack, the gear lash will kick in. But I think early on, and again from my influence with hanging out with people who appreciated the wonder of the 50s and early 60s guitars, it was so obvious. Go to Cluzons. And the curved truss rod. Just the whole thing. Fender may have accidentally got that right, but since we were all we built our lives on that and our sound and our concept of what's great, it was important.
Your departure, because this is very vintage inspired. Mm-hmm. Where the departure comes in the third pickup and then in the bridge. So you used this Goto or Schecter.
Goto TC-301.
Yeah.
I don't remember my phone number, but I, like anybody with advancing dementia, I remember the name of it. The third pickup we already talked about was driven by Sid Hudson. And, it became that thing that I was blatantly copying Fender. But then at a certain point, Fender copied us and invented the Nashville Tele 10 years into this. And I remember you coming to me with the idea that Peavey wanted to build you a red guitar and put a Bender in it. Mm-hmm. And I remember thinking, which was the stupidest thing in the world. I should have done it because, we sort of talked.
Peavey did build me some guitars.
Yeah. But I now when a OEM or a company, or certainly Fender, is building the Brent Mason model with Benders in it, we jump at that opportunity to provide that or secrets or whatever.
The timing is so terrible.
Oh, who knew? but it's funny the fact that I was just blatantly ripping Fender, and they never came after me at all. Whereas later they went after all these people. And one reason
they never did, huh?
No, because when this stuff was not getting used very much in Nashville. Tellies were. There were small handful of people, and then the group grew, and a lot of the stuff was custom stuff.
Yeah.
And the reason they didn't come after anybody is if somebody saw you on stage from more than five rows back, that's a Fender. So these were selling Fenders.
Yeah, they did. Yeah.
They weren't selling my guitars. These were selling Fenders.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Yeah.
Makes sense.
So why did you use the Goto bridge instead of the old-style bridge?
Again, it was the... it was driven by the idea that there were better things, and particularly intonation. And even though people had bent the Tele saddle to get it in tune, and it's actually, I don't like this bridge. I'm not fond of it. I don't think it sounds as good or is as stable. But it was an 80s thing, and it became a thing, and then everybody wanted it. We tried it on something, and everybody wanted it. For the mistaken concept that you can only really tune with six saddles, and that's better. And I regret it because today people put this thing on a pedestal. They put the six saddle Tele on a pedestal, whereas the brass saddle, the three brass saddle thing, it's got better downward tension because it's got two strings pushing two screws into the plate. There's much more force. It's a better material. I apologize for the six saddle Goto bridge.
However, they do have a sound, and obviously Steve and Ricky and Brent Mason and tons of people still have that bridge on their old guitars that you modified, and they sound great.
Well, because this is basswood, which I wasn't in love with the sound of basswood, but we used it to figure out because you had to. Unfortunately, you were a guinea pig. I don't know how we got there.
Thanks, Joe. Hey, I was with you, man. We were two kids just, hey, let's try this, I was so excited to see what you would do, like watching you paint, It's like, I remember you know, we were feeling our way through this stuff. I was couldn't wait to get my hands on and see what you had done, you know. And,
well, my side of it was I remember telling the guys in your band, I'll use this experimental wood on this guy. He won't know the difference. No, I don't know. I don't know where basswood came from, except that it was light, and I don't know why. I didn't make very many. I probably made 10 or 15 guitars out of basswood. Some of them, it sounded really good. But again, it's all the combination. So it's like maybe this wood and this bridge work together.
Right.
But this, I'm just not terribly fond of the bridge, and I feel guilty about it. But again, a guitar is the composite of its parts, and you can't say that three brass saddle bridge would make this guitar sound better. It might, and it might not at all.
Right.
So,
how did you feel when seeing Skaggs and Steve, you know, on stage together, like on the CMA Awards when they did Restless, and seeing the two of them together playing their matching benders, was that a nice feeling?
Two Glazer brother guitars out there,
dude. You can't imagine what the because here's the other thing. Okay, when I was a little kid, I remember I have a younger brother, a year younger, gifted musician who went and got a real job, worked for the airlines all his life. But he was a great musician. In fact, one, we played in a band together, and I remember him sitting down at my steel. He was playing bass in the band. I remember him sitting down at my steel and going, no, that's not how you get the sound. And he took the steel bar like this, you know, not this kind of, and he held it like that. And within 10 seconds, he had better tone than me. You know, he was
hate that guy. Yeah.
Here's how you slide, you know. But he would lay down. He was a Beach Boys nut in the very beginning. And he put the speakers, he'd lay on the floor and put the speakers there and go, listen to that bass. And I'd lay down and go, yeah. And I couldn't even pick the bass out. I mean, it just wasn't.
He just had that thing.
Like you. Yeah. Like probably as a you know, 5-6 year old, you already were listening to parts of the music.
Separating and stuff. Yeah.
So my brother, this is where this comes in. I remember laying in our room as little kids, and he had the Fender catalog. This was probably, we were probably 13 and 14 years old, or 9 and 10. And he had the Fender catalog from whatever year it was, where they had those Wildwood, you know, the colored instruments.
My uncle had a Wildwood.
You know, they put this paint in the tree when it's growing, I think.
Yeah.
Because it went into certain grain and not other grain. And I remember looking at that, and there was a picture of the steel. And I remember thinking, whatever that thing is, I'd already heard it. You know, it's like, that's what I want. All I ever wanted was to be somehow involved. And I ruled out being a musician or being a significant musician, because I realized I wasn't going to be. So to watch these guys on stage and be in the in the game. Today, this is still all. I mean, this is still like, you know, the pinch me moment is I got to do something useful.
Yeah,
it was incredible.
Joe, you definitely got involved. I'll say that much. Well, you know, geez, man.
But I'm lucky, because if you'd been a guitar repairman and you'd been a guitar repairman and the other 3,560 people here who play guitar were repairmen, I would be like in the lower 35% skill
level. I don't think he's accurate. Okay. Yeah, I don't believe that at all, Joe.
Joe, you're funny.
The fact that there's 11 guitar repairmen in Nashville or builders or something is, it's much better odds. So I did luck out.
Yeah, yeah.
I feel like we need to, again, this guitar has been just incredibly significant in your career. It's kind of become, you know, part of your look and your persona. People just kind of expect to see this red guitar. And let's see, you've got, you know, three pickups. It originally had the blade Seymour Duncan in the middle, but since then you've replaced them with Ron Ellis pickups.
Ron Ellis, yeah.
And that was because of your son, Ryan.
I played his, he had them in a guitar, and I flipped over them and really loved them. And then I had Ron make me these. I love my Seymour Duncans. Still have the original ones right in there, you know. But
what did it do for the sound? Tell me how do you hear it? How do you hear it?
Well, I think it was I was recording some things, and I was wanting more spanky, real telly, straight out of real telly kind of sound, more original, you know. And I think that's what I was kind of going for. But I'm, you know, talking about being open, you know, with Chad. I'm open to try. I can always put pop them right back in.
How did this Does this have a good second position?
Yeah, it does. I really like the second. Uh-huh. I do more stuff for that second position uh-huh. probably anywhere.
And these sound good. Yeah, that?
Very, very much.
He makes incredible.
Yeah, I'm really pleased. And although I do love my Duncans too, but
this is what I think is best.
Yes, tell us about the back.
Well, belt buckles, you know, playing in Texas, Oklahoma, wearing those big belt buckles in the day. I remember coming into your shop. Kevin Marks, my sound engineer years ago, he used to put, and Tommy, I talked about my guitar tech, they used to put black tape on it, cover it up, because I would always gripe and I go, man, I'm getting chips all in my Manuel coats here, you know. And so I'd have little splinters and stuff from acting like a fool during the show and getting splinters everywhere. And so they put a piece of black tape, and that's still some of the black tape.
Adhesive,
I guess. And so I remember one day, long time ago, I came in, you set this down, and you turned it over, and you saw the black tape, and you just go and ripped it off. And I go, oh, okay, that tape's off now.
Yeah.
You know? So, and really, you made a comment.
I apologize.
No, I love it. And I loved it, though, because you go, man, that's too cool. And I was with you. You were saying, you know, you were like, hey, that's part of it. You know, and we were laughing about it. Actually, it was a... But it's, you know, it's, that's just, those are battle scars, you know. So
it's
battle scars, yeah. You know. So, and I don't know if you want to jump to it now, but it got to a point when I was flying a lot and I really didn't want to take this guitar, flying it so much and everything. I just hated to do it. And I was afraid I'd get out and something happened to it. Well, I wanted to have a backup in case I wanted to fly this instead of this. And so I had our friend, your mutual friend and mm-hmm. mine, Jeff Sin, mm-hmm. made me a backup for it. And I know you've seen this guitar, but it's so hilarious, isn't it? It's like, and I've only had this a couple of years, I think. But
he did such a great job.
He went to such
detail. The shape
detail.
Of the knobs, everything. He got everything.
If you can see right. this up close, even the back, it's like ridiculous how he how he went so far.
And he did this.
He studied this. He's really an artist, isn't he? Yeah. I mean, you guys both, you're just artists. But to do that, and so sometimes I'll... if I'm flying and stuff, I'll take that one and just not chance this one, you know.
He really got the color close.
Pretty close.
That's
yeah.
the first thing that shocked me was how close
pretty
the shades
close.
Were.
Yeah, slightly oranger, but it's incredibly close.
Yeah, just really, really a piece of art. Both are just art. And so sometimes I'll fly, if I'm flying or whatever, I'll take that one instead. And I don't like chancing this one anymore. So.
And he even kind of imitated your logo.
He did.
It's a
no, it's so
bender.
Great. It looks like the same spaghetti.
Yolks. That's so wonderful.
It's so great. Yeah. What a, it's
what a
really
tribute.
It's really a tribute. Yeah. So even to these little, if you look, Zach, you know, even to these little... These little places are all...
Yeah. Whether it's an appropriate moment or not, would you hold those two things up?
It's always an appropriate moment.
I've wanted to get this photo for a while.
We should do one of us, too. Isn't that great?
Yeah.
And my guitar tech, one day he brought out... During the show, he whispers, he goes, do you know which guitar? He took it away, and boy, I went to an acoustic, and as he's leaving, he goes, do you know which one that was? And I go, no, I don't have a clue. Because it really, they feel very...
Do they sound similar?
Yeah, very much so. They really feel similar, too.
Yeah, that's just
it's ridiculous,
marvelous,
isn't it?
Mm-hmm. That's really incredible.
He's really an artist, man. And then you... You did the B bender.
Yeah, it's the most modern bender.
Yep. And then we got it down to that place, and then Joe put the bender.
Are these Ron Ellis pickups too?
Yeah, they're the same, the Ellis. That's crazy.
He's got, I mean, the Ron Ellis pickups are so great.
They are.
Yeah, they're pretty badass.
Yeah. So Joe, you... The benders used to take a long time to get an install. I remember, mm-hmm. you know, of course, mm-hmm. getting them back in the 90s and such, and there was quite a wait. But with the redesigned bender, which this one has, people, you know, there's a pretty quick, you know, turnaround, you know, and they can go online and they can get on a schedule their vendor and send it off to you, and they can get it pretty quick now.
Yeah. Well, you know, I never felt proud of the fact that it took us months.
Yeah.
Partly it was because I had a guy who was doing the vendor stuff, and he spent a fair amount of time. He was part-time, but he was also innovating. You know, he spent a lot of time designing and stuff. But we didn't turn them out very rapidly, and they had to be hand done, the whole thing. And so in 2018, and partly because at about that time Brad Paisley had a Fender model coming out, and he called me and asked me if I would be interested in doing a Bender for it. And I said, yeah. And I began thinking that very quickly I needed something that could be installed quickly, easily and rapidly. And so in 2018, I redesigned it. And the whole goal was to deal with the issues, which were that, A, it would have to be mass-produced so that we weren't sitting there cutting pieces of metal all day long. B, that it needed to drop in quickly. Needed to be B or G convertible because of Brad and Olander and Jeff King, who they play a G down.
They do double pulls.
Yeah. Well, Olander does a double, but Brad and Jeff King do the G. And I also wanted to be to have throw options, because a lot of the early guys playing the Parsons wide or Gene Parsons benders, that's a longer throw. Oh, yeah, so I wanted something that could be short for someone like Brad. And so I redesigned it. And the good thing is that, you know, it takes about a little over an hour to put it in, and actually 2 minutes to install it, but an hour to do, you know, take the guitar apart and do all that stuff. So that took the time frame out of it and made it much more adjustable and made it so that other companies could do it. So yeah, it was a total transformation over the days of having to tell people for months on end that their guitar wasn't ready yet.
Yeah.
I apologize for that too.
And I know that feeling.
Yes.
Well, it's like a kid at Christmas. You're like, oh my gosh, I can't wait to get it, you know.
Well, you guys always got priority. I think I may have done more than one. I think I did another bender for you and something else at some point. But
yeah, you did. You've done it. I think I have three or four of yours. Only these two red ones, but mm-hmm. I do have a couple of others.
So. The local actual players. I mean, I've always felt like you have to tip to the people who are making a living.
Yeah.
And so that was always much faster. But now it's, and people would call up and go, you have to be somebody to get one of these things, don't you? And I go, no, we're just slow. But now I feel like we're making it up to people, because it's a 1 day, 3 day, 4 day turnaround.
Right.
And that's, you know, if I do this another 50 or 60 years, I might have made up for all the time of making people wait.
I even hear of people, you know, scheduling it to where they'll have the bender done and they fly in or drive into Nashville and they pick it up from the shop.
Or drive in.
Wow, that's cool.
Drive in the morning, pick it up in the afternoon. You know, as long as they let us know, we can do that. I want to do that. You know, I want them to be treated the way I'd want to be treated, which is that if something's important to them, it's important to us.
And, you know, of course you have all sorts of, items that you've created through Music City Bridge, you know, wrap over tail pieces and locking studs and things to fix the bracings and acoustics and all sorts of stuff that, and that's that inventor entrepreneur part of you that, goes on and on.
Speaking of that, I have a question. Have you always been that way? Like, as a kid, were you an inventor kind of kid? Did you want to take something apart and see how it was made as a kid?
Yeah, and it started out with like firecrackers and apples, where you put the firecracker in the apple and watch.
Yeah, baby.
You know, I was going to say something about the thing about people flying to town and all that. One thing I've learned over the years is that you have to say yes to everybody. My brother, who was he's the king of customer service, and he would lecture me from his experience in the airlines, he would say, you know, it's customer service. I go, yeah. Yes is the question. Yes is the answer. What is the question? That was his motto. And so I learned that. And a more complex version of it, I tell my guys at the shop and everybody, when I go travel and train people, I go, you got to be nice to everybody because you don't know who somebody is, particularly in Nashville. They're not going to tell you. In Nashville, right. One of the wonderful things is they're not going to say, I'm so-and-so, I played on all these records. You have to find that out for yourself.
There's some people that do, but a lot don't. Yeah.
So how long have you been here from Los Angeles? You
know? Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, there are people, yeah, with the exception of those guys who in Facebook, you know, so-and-so dies, and they publish the picture of themselves with...
2 seconds later.
With Jeff Beck. Here I am with... Sad to see Jeff Beck go. Here I am with Jeff Beck, you know.
Yeah.
But you don't know who somebody is.
That's true.
You don't know who they were.
Right.
And you don't know who they will be. And my whole career was made on making sure there was time for people who seemed to be on their way somewhere. You know, they had that glint in their eye, or they were, you watched them play and he was like, wow, look at, what did he just do? Or just something.
And you just don't know, do you?
You just don't know. And the fact that Chet, for instance, this is remarkable. I have this picture in my shop of Chet and Steve.
Oh, I love that picture.
And it looks like one of those Christmas pictures of the angels, you know, the little baby faces. And it's wonderful. But Chet saw that. And he didn't – you look at these guys who are serial discoverers. They didn't bet on fully blown people. They built on people who were up and coming and very much in the infant stage. And that remarkable
vision.
Yeah. And some of it you don't know. Some of it's luck. You know, it's like, was I lucky that to build for Olander and these guys early on, Skaggs and you, or was it? I don't think so. I was a huge fan. I heard you guys play, and it's like, okay, that's what I'm interested in. But you have to bet on people, well, 5 years before they're successful. If you know, guitar guys come up to me and go, man, can you get a guitar to Keith Urban or whoever it is? I go, no, dude, you're 40 years late. You know, you have to find those people when they're up and coming and when they come in and say, man, I don't really have the money now, but could you do this thing and I'll make it good? And you have to go,
yes,
don't worry about it. You have to, and this is true of the ideas, like you're talking about the tools and stuff, and so, you know, we build software and have done software startups. If you're not planning 5 years down the road ahead of the fad, musically, it's true too. If you're doing, to change the world, Randy Travis had to be so far ahead of the neo-traditional country that people would listen to him and go, oh, not that. Because if he'd been the third guy doing it after he already made it successful, they'd go, well, yeah, here's a deal. We'll sign you. We hope to get 1% of the market. Whereas if you're that leading, whatever it is, you're going to get 20, 25% of the market. You got to bet on that. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Absolutely.
Yes.
Wow.
By the way, that picture... I'm playing bass. We were playing the song called Frog Kissing. And number two, it's in Hilversum, the Netherlands.
How do you know that?
I just do. I don't know. I know exactly where that is. It's
The song you were doing.
I only sang a couple songs with him. He only sang like 2 songs in the show. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I knew that. I could tell that was Frog. It's a song, I think... Buddy Cab wrote it. It's called Frog Kiss, and it's really funny.
That's amazing. Did you know who took the picture?
Mm-mm.
So there's a guy named Manfred Peter, however it's pronounced. He's German. And he was a huge country music nut, still is. And he would come over here every year, and he'd go hang out with Fred Newell and stuff. And he'd come and he'd bring me all these pictures that he had taken because he's a photographer and a guitar player. I built a guitar for him. And he... would bring the stack, and that was in that stack of stuff. So he took it, and he took that at that gig. And I love the picture.
I do, too. I love that, too, have it hanging there. That's fantastic. Chet would be loving that, too, man. That's cool.
thank Steve and Joe for, and especially to Steve for making this happen. Man. This was Steve's idea. So if it's a hit, it's
I have to say, Ryan, my son, Ryan said, "Dad, this is something you should do." I got to give him the kudos on that because I appreciate you guys' time. You do so many cool things. All your stuff is wonderful. We're appreciative for what you do. Well, so many great interviews and.
That's really true. That's some cool stuff. It's changed everything.
Yeah, man.
You guys are my heroes. So,
man. Yeah. Joe, thanks for your time, man.
Yeah. Thank you, Joe.
So good.
Thank you for all this, all these years.
Yes. All right.
Oh, so good.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to the Ask Zach podcast. If you want to dive deeper, check out my website, askzach.com, to find more articles and further info on each episode. And remember, it is the support from you, the listener, that keeps the show going. Thank you, friends.